cool to be.
I'd
disabled.
Like us all to be one big.
Not necessarily the most politically.
I surely don't need to tell you.
Has it really changed your life? That
you've let somebody drill into you.
Hello and welcome to Ouch Talk Show number 100. And how could we possibly mark such a milestone, Rob?
Well, we had a good long think about this, and listeners, we've decided to bow to pressure and do a special show dedicated to the subject of SEX.
We have three smoking hot guests primed and ready for a frank exchange.
And this show does contain some adult themes. In the BBC way, it won't be gratuitous, but it might be uncomfortable listening if you're sharing the room with a child. So switch off now and we'll be back to normal in our October edition. And for those of you who are still with us, here are some of the things we'll be discussing, including sex for people with high care needs.
Are you more likely to be gay if you're disabled?
And is it ever okay to fancy someone's disabled bits?
Not sure what your disabled bits are, but I'm certainly going to be staying tuned.
And if anyone would turn off now.
Ouch! Disability Talk from the BBC with Rob Crossan and Kate Monaghan.
So, this is your last chance. It's time to turn off now if discussing disability, sex and personal relationships could be embarrassing, either to you or to somebody you're sitting in the room listening with. Maybe you're sitting with your mum and dad and think, no, this is not for me. Now's your chance and don't say we didn't warn you. Anyway, with us, we've got three guests, Asta, Daryl and on the line from Toronto in Canada, it's Kirsty.
Hello to you all.
Hi, nice.
Hello.
Oh, there you are, Kirsty. Fantastic. Right, well, let's go around the table then. Asta Philpott. Now, you've got... can you help me pronounce this one? It's arthrogryposis.
Posis.
Posis.
Yeah.
Posis. Okay.
Nearly there.
Which for you means you can't use your arms or legs. Is that right? Okay.
Yeah.
So, obviously, these are quite important limbs for the subject we're talking about today.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And now... Asta, you lost your virginity at a specialist Spanish brothel, then fronted a BBC documentary where you took two other disabled fellas to do the same thing. It's quite kind of controversial, and I believe you're now campaigning for there to be similar accessible sex facilities in the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been going since about 2007, and we're in 2013, and I'm still campaigning for the same thing. So.
Daryl Beaton, you are a theatre director, and you use a wheelchair and crutches to get around.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So diversity is a focus of your work, and much of your social life is in the gay community. Is there a big disabled gay community, Daryl?
Oh, gosh. When I was asked this question, I was thinking about the disabled people I know and what percentage of them are gay, and I would say actually it was quite high.
And finally, we've got Kirsty Lydiard, one of the only academics in the world specifically studying sex and disability, and you may have heard her on the show back in February. So just very quickly, in a couple of words, Kirsty, how do you fall into something like this, what you do?
Just, I'm a disabled woman myself, very sexual woman, so it was always kind of an interest of mine. Being a sociologist as well, I wanted to explore disabled people's experiences of their sexual lives, really.
Okay, so Kirsty is our expert, and she's also here to bolster the side for disabled women, because wanting to make love, as we know, is not just a disabled male thing. That may have been sort of slightly overlooked in the past.
It always sounds a bit creepy when you say make love.
It does, doesn't it? You can't say without sounding like I want to be in a Luther Vandross video.
Exactly. Anyway, let's start with you then, Asta. So tell us about what it was like growing up with a disability like yours. Did sex cross your mind much as a young lad?
Yeah, well, I guess it started hitting my mind at the age of 16, 17, when I was surrounded by friends and who started to kind of talk about the subject and have sex themselves and stuff, and I mixed with a lot of able-bodied people. So for me, in that sense, it was a lot worse because it was happening around me a lot more, and I always wanted this experience, and I always wondered, well, why shouldn't I,
But you weren't short of female attention. It was just all entirely platonic.
Yeah, absolutely. It was all kind of friendship and stuff like that, and very light. And so, it was tough.
And you had a lot of girls saying things to you. I imagine that I know a lot of male disabled people get this. They have female friends who say, "Oh, you're like a brother to me," or like,
"Yeah,
you're my best friend." And that's incredibly annoying. When,
yeah,
frankly,
absolutely.
You want to have sex.
Or I think the line is, "I'm not ready for a relationship yet," and then 2 weeks later, you see them in a relationship. So it's what?
So did you feel like you the whole idea of adolescent sex and exploring everything and popping your cherry. It felt like a party that you weren't invited to.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was worse for me because I can't use my hands, so I couldn't kind of explore things myself in the way able-bodied people do. So,
as in, you know, finding out what it would be like just to do it yourself, DIY methods.
Absolutely, yeah. And it, you know, like I say, I'm immobile. My arms and legs, I can't move. So, I mean, even like down to, you know, someone asked me, well, couldn't you have asked your mum or dad to help you? I was like, what? Whoa! Hang on a minute.
Did someone actually say that to you?
They were like, well, what about your mum and dad? I was like, really? Would you do that with your mum and dad? Maybe not.
That is extraordinary.
Don't even go there.
Now, we mentioned earlier that you made a show for BBC One about going to a specialist brothel in Spain on Costa Brava, which they welcome and encourage and have facilities for disabled customers. And I was thinking about this earlier, and it seems that not only did most people understand how an orgasm feels like a long time before they pop their cherry and lose their virginity because they've done it to themselves, but for you, not only did you lose your virginity, I presume it was also, if you don't mind me being so it was also your first orgasm as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, this must have been an absolutely incredible moment for you. I mean,
It was from the time I stepped over the threshold in the place we went to in Spain, Eclipse. It was just absolutely mind-blowing, the end result. And my mum, I'll always remember what my dad and uncle said at the end. They were like, I came out of the room and they said, I just completely look like a new guy. And I just
glowing.
Yeah, absolutely. And
So how old were you when you made that decision? And what made you decide to go there? And also, why Spain?
Yeah, I was growing up, like from the age of 20, I'd say. I started talking about this, obviously, more and more with my parents. And my dad was like, okay, I'm going to explore this and see what that can be done and like look at the situation in England. And he did all his research and he actually visited places in England. And it was just like, he came back home and he was like, no, you're not going to any of these places because they were just so underground and dark and seedy. And that was just because of the state of play in England. So luck have it, you know, we were on holiday in Spain and the landlord, the Irish landlord of the Irish bar said, there's this amazing place down the road, do you know about it? And we're like, nope.
And this was 7 years ago and you were how old?
25.
So
what made you so absolutely certain that this was the only way you were going to lose your virginity?
Because in my heart of hearts, I knew for a fact that I didn't even know whether I could do this, or I didn't feel like sexually confident with myself because I'd never explored this territory with myself or with anyone else. So and I didn't even, I know there's the kind of taboo around prostitution and everything, but that didn't even come into my head. You know, it's like, yeah, I wanted to go somewhere where people were being treated right and stuff like this, but you know, for me it was, I just needed this experience. And you know, yeah, there was people judging and stuff like that, but I didn't really care.
But it could have, you know, to play devil's advocate, it might have been nothing to do with your disability as to why you weren't getting sex. But, you know, I don't know, maybe you had bad breath or just wore terrible shirts. I don't know.
Maybe.
Did you think about all that as well?
I have amazing shirts and I have amazing...
I was going to say, he's looking pretty good. He's looking very good.
Oh, thank you.
Morning, yeah.
Thank you very much. I think, I don't think there was anything wrong with my, like, fashion at the time. I think I know for a fact it was because of my image and my disabled image, this image that people kind of judge you on instantly without getting to know the person within. So
were you just hanging around with the wrong crowd of people though, if people were judging you that harshly on how you look? Because you look pretty cool to me, so.
Oh, thank you. Maybe I was just, I don't know, I'd go out every weekend with my uncle to the local nightclubs and you'd get your women saying, oh, you're having a nice night, love, it's good, you could come out. And most of the time I just turn around and like, beep. But people judge you on image and they still do in life. And I think it's crazy actually that we're still debating a topic like this, because no judgments or perceptions or image orientated judgment should be anywhere.
So if you don't mind, Astra, I'm going to take you back to the brothel in Spain. Not literally.
Really?
I'm sorry to say that. Budget won't allow it. You chose to remain in your chair while you were having sex with this girl. Was there a reason why you wanted to do that? Why?
I just wanted the situation to be as independent as possible. And I wanted to have that experience myself, just me and the lady I was with, without having to get into the logistic wranglings of it. So I know I was in like a brothel and stuff like that, and my dad and my uncle were down in the bar, but I wanted just to be that independence. So, but it was just like, when I got up to the room with the girl, she couldn't speak a word of English, and just like simple thing of getting her to take my seatbelt off and explaining that I need to do it in my wheelchair. It was like, it must have been like 20 minutes just explaining, and I actually...
That's valuable time you're wasting.
I actually said to her, I hope this isn't on the clock. But
surprisingly savvy for your first visit. Anyway.
But wouldn't it have been more comfortable for all concerned if you had been lying down
on
in a bed? I mean,
looking at
your wheelchair now, it's quite small. Is that not quite an uncomfortable place to...
No, not really. It was actually quite cool, because my chair reclines into a lying down position, and this girl was quite athletic. So, you know,
nice.
Like... positions for this girl just weren't a problem. So
now I know that you've had a relationship, maybe more than one relationship, since your brothel encounters.
Yeah,
I presume now you've actually had sex where you haven't paid for it.
Absolutely.
Now that you can tell the difference between brothel sex and the relationship, does it make you think about the whole brothel experience in a slightly different light?
Yeah, I mean, certainly for my first time in a brothel, it was amazing, and I would never regret that experience, and I'd always support someone with a disability who wanted to go down that road. But in terms of relationships and brothels, yeah, it's completely different. The only problem with sleeping with an escort is that, for me anyway, after the experience, I couldn't take that loving experience away with me. So every time I had an experience like that, it was crushing, because I wanted love forever. I just didn't want it within that fleeting time I was with someone. But obviously when I was in relationships, it was much more incredible, because the person loved me for however long we were together, and there were no barriers.
Why are you advocating something that you just described as crushing, though?
Well, because you've got to really put it in context. So it's like, you want this sexual experience, take it for what it is, see it as a business transaction, come away from it, that's it, cut it off, use it for that one experience that you want, use it to build your confidence. But don't rely on something like that, because it's not something that I could rely on personally.
And you really were afraid, I suppose, at the age of 25, that you were never, ever going to have sex.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it came from... I hung out with my friend a lot in school, Andriano, and he had muscular dystrophy. And I was swimming one day with my physio, and I came out of the swimming bath, and she said, I didn't want to tell you this before, but Andriano passed away last night. And we always used to talk about sex and him wanting an intimate experience, and he died without ever having that, and he could never speak with his mum and dad about his feelings. And over the past few years, more and more people are writing to me with the same problem. A couple of guys wrote to me from Ireland last week with the same problem, but then a mum wrote to me, so it's mixed. So this is why I'm on the trail I am. I don't think anyone should pass away without wanting an experience like that.
What is the trail that you're going on? What are you hoping to campaign for?
Well, certainly the people with disabilities who want this experience and who need help with it, it shouldn't be so difficult. So, say, for instance, the news story about the care home, when it all blew up, the escorts went into the care home and helped people with disabilities. It shouldn't have been like that. It shouldn't have blown up into the press. It should have been a process for the disabled person that was beautiful and amazing. So if a person with a disability goes into the care home, it should be included within their care plan, some kind of intimacy, because it's not all about whether we need our arses wiping or whether we need feeding or whether we need bathing or this or that. People tend to skirt over the subject instead of really embracing it and, you know, realising what people need.
So we've got a clip here of the documentary you fronted. So let's just recap, Asta. So you took two disabled men to lose their virginity in Spain, just as you had done previously.
Yeah.
One of them is a fellow called Lee, who's a blind man, and here he is in a bar getting a braille feel, shall we call it, of the sex worker who he's shortly going to be sleeping with.
Do you like?
I like.
You see? You like?
Yes.
You look very nice.
Yes. And you?
Yes, thank you. You smell nice.
Yes?
Yes.
Oof, blimey, that's got me a little hot under the collar there. Kirsty, coming to you now. Do you think Asta's story is quite typical? Do you think there are lots of disabled men who do demand visits to sex workers?
Yeah, listening to Asta's story, it's incredibly familiar from many of the stories I heard in my work. Things like, you know, feeling as a teenager that you're never going to have sex. Quite a lot of anxiety around, can I even be a sexual person? Is my body going to be able to have sex in the ways that I want and choose? And for many young disabled men particularly, sex work offers a way to explore and to find out about your body and to gain sexual experience or sexual skills that you might then want to take into future relationships like Asta has. So it is quite common, yeah.
And is there a demand for the sex workers for women as well?
Not really. There's no, I wouldn't say there's
and
the same kind
that?
Of demand.
Why is that?
There's a combination of different reasons. The ways we think about sexuality and gender are very different for men and women. I think it's very difficult for women to make the choice to pay for sex, to even consider it, to talk about it, to ask for support maybe to do it as men do, like Asta did with his parents.
Can you tell us about the first sexual experience of one of the women that you've been chatting to?
Yeah, well, the one woman I've got in mind, she was a very young disabled woman at the time of interview, had quite a significant level of impairment, used an electric wheelchair, and was, you know, again, about this issue around body image. She was just so devastated, really, that her body image as she saw it didn't live up to the very idea, you know, the media instillment of this very sexy body that we have. And she was just, you know, just hated herself, didn't ever imagine that she could attract a partner, didn't imagine that she would even be worthy of being in an intimate relationship or being loved by somebody else. And I think this is very common, but for this one particular woman, she just went through this, you know, years and years of self-hatred and worrying about the future and worrying about not being able to talk to other people about it. And she said that she could never speak to her parents about sex or even her feelings about not feeling like a sexual person. She couldn't talk to friends about it. She felt very left out, particularly
So what did she do to try and help herself?
Well, it's a progression, really. She ended up going to university, which really brought her out of herself. It pushed her into new spaces that she wouldn't have otherwise have been. It gave her confidence that she was educating herself and learning about the world. And it was really a transition for her. And I think it's a transition that many young people go through. And she ended up finding a partner just at uni, as anybody else would, and is in a very happy relationship now as a result. But it seems to be there's this quite long period. It takes a long time to find that, you know, loving relationship for many people. So she struggled a lot, as many other young disabled women did. And I think there's this issue as well that we tend to speak to young disabled women a lot less about sex maybe than we do young disabled men. She knew from disability communities and groups that she was part of that young disabled men spoke about sex quite a lot and were spoken to about sex, and she said that nobody ever did that with her, so she never really had that outlet to express how she felt to anybody, which might have, you know, helped her resolve these particular issues that she had a lot earlier had there been an open forum for her to talk about sex.
So let's get another perspective on this. He's been sitting very quietly opposite the table from me. We'll say hello to Daryl. Hello, Daryl.
Hi.
Daryl, amongst us disabled folk in the chattering classes, I think there's a perception, and it really is just a perception, we have no research on this at all, but that there might be a higher number of gay people in the disabled world than there is in the able-bodied world. So from your perspective as a gay disabled man, is that a good observation?
Well, do you know what? As you say, it's really difficult to say without doing any sort of research or working out on numbers. But I think it might be just that disabled people, we're already sort of, you know, on the fringes, as it were. Mm. So actually, if you're not fitting into a model of normality already, then it's much easier to, I suppose, come out, as it were. A lot of disabled people aren't necessarily perceived to have a normal route through life anyway.
What does it mean to be on the fringes already? What does that mean?
Well, I just mean in terms of being a disabled person within mainstream society. So actually, we spend a lot of of our time already with a level of perceptions of what we are able or not able to do and perceptions of what our life will be. So in a way, I see it that maybe we're just defining our own boundaries and our own rules, and therefore there's more space to sort of come out and or to be different, as it were.
Kirsty.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by this theory. I'd love to go out and research it as a new idea for research there. But I don't know. I think Daryl's absolutely right. If you're excluded from the kind of mainstream sexual culture than other people are, then that maybe gives you a sense of maybe liberation, that you don't have to conform to these very standardized ways of being sexual. And then that might lead into exploring other ways of being sexual with different types of people, not necessarily heterosexual desire and things, maybe.
So, Daryl, is it easy to be gay if you're disabled then? Can we put it as bluntly as that?
Is it easy to be gay if you're disabled? That's a really blunt question. I think being gay and disabled, you're like any other disabled person, you're still facing those barriers. You know, gay clubs really aren't that accessible for a start.
Why not?
Why not? Because they tend to, well, the good ones tend to be in basements.
There's a lot of steps.
There's a lot of steps and there's little lights and it's very sweaty and steamy. And they tend to be the best ones. But also, you know, I talk from a gay man perspective. There is a model, I suppose, you know, of what a gay man should look like. You know, within the gay media, there's lots of ripped men in muscles and rubbing baby oil. This really tells the sort of places I go to.
Going back to the 80s now.
I know, but that's when I grew up. That's when I was discovering my sexuality. And that's the sort of images that I was facing at the time in the places that I was going to.
So how did that affect your own relationships then?
Well, I sort of remember late nights watching telly and seeing images of men on TV and becoming aroused, and at the same time thinking, oh, I can't be gay as well, was my first response. But it's slightly differently because being somebody with a visible disability, I don't sort of have to come out as being disabled. People can see that. But what I found a lot of experiences when I was younger, if I was in a bar or a club or something and I'm sat down, you know, sat down with a table in front of me, I don't look visibly disabled. And if that was in a gay bar environment, I realised that every time I stood up, I was actually coming out as disabled. So there was this weird sort of role reversal in a way.
Do you think your parents were more understanding about you being gay because of your disability? That maybe they thought, well, he has more options now, you know?
No, do you know what? I think my parents reacted. I believe my parents would have reacted the same if I was non-disabled, because I grew up, my best friend since seven came out when we were like 14, and his parents reacted exactly the same way as mine did when I came out much
later.
What
was the reaction then?
Just, you know, mum's upset, she's never going to have grandkids. And I grew up in the Midlands, and sort of my dad's quite northern. But his reaction was very much sort of like, OK, well, your mum's told me, what do you want with your chips for tea? You know.
That sounds like quite a sort of satisfying result.
Yeah, no, absolutely it was. I mean, it was something that wasn't really then spoken about for the years afterwards. But what is interesting is other people's reactions. So when I was at university, people's reactions were like, oh, that's a shame that you're disabled and gay. Because in a way, that's like a double whammy. As in, you know, I only needed to be sort of black and I would have had the trio.
Yeah, then you'd have been a triple threat.
Yeah, exactly.
How about starting relationships with somebody new? Do you think, are the gay community more accepting of a difference like disability? Or do you think they're actually sort of harsher on people? Does it not make any difference?
It's difficult. The gay community is a massive community built up of loads of sub-communities, if you like. So there are the body beautiful end of the spectrum, but there's also the non. I think the gay community is much more open to the area of diversity. I always say that homosexuality and disability is the one thing really that should unite society, because it doesn't care about race, gender, age, what country you're from. You know, it should be a unifying aspect. But I do think that, you know, gay people are part of mainstream society, and mainstream society does have perceptions, wrong or right perceptions of disability, and that does influence gay culture.
And did you find your disability was a barrier at all to your first sexual experiences?
I suppose it was, but I think that came much more from my perception of what another gay man would be looking for. So in a way, I think it was much more internal than external. I would be the one that was probably holding holding back the most. But I suppose, you know, the opportunities for sort of sexual interaction within the gay community are much wider. You can, if you really wanted to, just nip into a dark room where there's no lights on and have sex with a complete stranger. Or you can go to Hampstead Heath and go into the bushes. You know, there's a lot more options.
Pangs of jealousy here, Aster. Would you like something like this to happen on the hetero side?
Well, I'd like to go into Hampstead Heath in the bushes. but I can certainly see what Daryl means about when you said, you know, you're sitting in a club at a table and no one would know you're disabled. I put myself on a dating site once and I didn't mention that I had a disability, and I got loads and loads of emails. Like, I'm not being big-headed, but I got emails asking for dates and stuff. And then when I had to tell them I had a disability, and then there was just like no more emails. So
the trail completely went cold.
Yeah, and I put myself on as having a disability, and I just didn't get any emails whatsoever. So I think it's really interesting, that part of it. And, you know, it is very image-orientated. If you had a Burns injury under your top, you wouldn't get treated any different in society. But if you had a burn on your face or a physical disability, then you get completely, like, on the phone or anything.
Would you date somebody with a physical disability?
Yeah, I would. This is going to sound really bad, but to a certain degree, because I've also got to think about mine and their lives being even more difficult than they are. So I've just got to be really careful on that level. And also, if I have a sexual experience, I'd like it to be between me and my partner and not me, the carer, and my partner. So I just think, but I'm not ruling it out, but it's got to be, I think, in the right...
So you do have some parameters that you set on other people.
I don't think I'd be normal if I didn't have parameters. I think that's what makes us as human beings. And I'm not going to lie to myself or anyone else.
What about you, Daryl? Would you date someone with a physical disability?
I have done in the past. I don't see it as any different. And I think it comes down to sort of personal desire and attraction as well at the end of the day.
And what about you, Kirsty? Would a physical disability put you off anybody?
Absolutely. It wouldn't. No, sorry, I was going to say absolutely.
I was going to say, that's an answer I wasn't expecting.
That would be impressive.
I was also going to say I wouldn't rule anyone out, but then I realised, no, you don't want to be saying that. But no, it absolutely wouldn't make a difference to me. Not at all, no.
What about you, Rob? Would there be people you wouldn't date?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course there'd be people I wouldn't date.
But what about because of their disability?
Yes, probably. Yeah, if it got to the point where my lack of vision and the disability that they had made us incapable of having an independent life together, then I don't think I would be very interested
in
that. Yeah, I'd want someone who could compensate for my physical flaws, frankly. And what about you?
I don't know.
You have to. You can't get away with it.
It's not like you weren't expecting it. We asked everybody. You knew it was going to come round to you at some point.
I like to be the question master, not the question answerer. I'd like to be very liberal and say anything goes, you know. But I don't know how I'd feel about somebody being hoisted upon me in the bedroom. That might be taking it a bit far. But
Aster,
who knows?
I think you're out of the running there.
I've never tried that.
Well, the biggest event related, I suppose, to sex and relationships and intimacy, and these are all things that are incredibly important with the emails we get at Ouch. The biggest event in the disability calendar here in the UK is the Sex Maniacs Ball, which is, for those who aren't aware, it's a sort of flamboyant, fetishistic affair that happens every September. Now, what's going on here then? I know, Daryl, you've got some thoughts about this. Let's try and tread carefully about fetishes, but yeah, what's your take on this?
No, I just commented that, you know, actually out of the... gay disabled people I know, I would say that a high proportion of those are much more into the fetish scene. And what I was saying is I quite actually also, and maybe I will when I leave today, do a piece of research or just to ask the questions as to why are you into that fetish area? And is it something to do with childhood? Is it something to do with being in hospital clinical environment? Is there something in there to do with the sort of level of care people receive? And because a lot of memories for me as a child are, you know, hoist in and out of beds, weird machines next to a bed, or being bed-bathed, you know. There's all of those.
So is that what you're into? Are you into a hoist?
Am I into a hoist? It depends what day of the week it is. I think there's nothing wrong with being sexually
explorative. It's Thursday today. How does it feel
today? It's Thursday today. Oh, then no, hoist is generally a Saturday.
And what about you, Esther? Is that kind of thing turning you on?
I think domination is certainly kind of... lingering in my left side of my brain. And I think Daryl's absolutely right in that, you know, you grow up with being cared for, looked after, and all these things around you. And
so you want to have the being able to turn the tables in the bedroom, basically, and take over some of that power.
Yeah, I think it's mainly down to people treading around eggshells around you. I think I'd like it to be a bit more like, I don't know. I'm going to get myself into all sorts here. A bit more forceful, because I'm always, well, not recently, but I'm always treated delicately and bubble wrap. But really, I'd just like to be thrown about the bedroom.
Kirsty?
I was just going to jump in. Yeah, this fetish talk's really interesting in the sense that, it gives birth to the idea, I guess, how much sexier our sex lives can be as disabled people. What kind of weird, wonderful experiences we can have. That's certainly one of the things that I've learned from listening to lots of disabled people talk about sex. If we're not kind of bogged down by the typical penetrative idea about sex, we have the chance to explore our bodies and have sex in really fun and in innovative ways as we otherwise wouldn't, maybe as non-disabled people wouldn't even think to go there, or we might like that. So there's so much possibility as well, which is quite exciting.
What about people who fetishize disabled people and are turned on by our different bodies and stuff? Have any of you guys encountered what are called devotees?
I haven't encountered them, but holy hell, where do they live? But I've heard that the fetish is out there, and I think, if we do have devotees in that area, then why not? Because we need as many devotees as possible.
That's something that quite a lot of disabled people do hate and think it's bad. What do you think, Daryl?
I've never, I've never come across it myself. Yeah,
that you know of.
That I know of. I would say that I've experienced, the sympathy shag.
Yeah.
But do you know what?
And did you just take that for what it was, or were you mildly offended or affronted by that?
No, I was fine. I was quite happy with the outcome. it also comes down to the context. So what is the context that devotee is approaching you on? What is the level of that? How much of it is a shared understanding of the situation that's happening? Because actually, there are people that fetishize or fantasize by lots of different things beyond disability. You've got chubby chasers, for example, and there's whole areas of things. Then actually, if it's a mutual thing, then that's not an issue. I suppose it's when it becomes a one-sided, secretive approach, then I think that's why some people concerns with it.
Well, let's talk about carers, because it's something that a lot of Ouch listeners, I believe, are in a situation where they're in very close physical contact with a carer who often can be of the opposite sex. And so if you're a man especially, this is the case. And obviously we noticed when you came in this morning, Asta, you've got a female care worker. Mm-hmm. I mean, how does that sort of dynamic work for you?
In terms of me and Alex being the carer and Alex being a friend, absolutely amazing. But for me, it stops there because Alex is my friend and carer, and I would never actually go down that route. Yeah, Alex does physical things for me, but I think of her more like my sister. Or when you're getting ready in the morning and stuff like that, if you kind of get excited, it's a bit embarrassing, but you kind of have that mutual understanding that it's, Alex has her relationship and I'll have my relationships, and I don't go there.
Well, earlier in August, the Outsiders Club, and these are the same people who are behind the Sex Maniacs Ball, who I heard a little groan there, but we'll carry on. The Outsiders Club had a jamboree afternoon. Now, our reporter Emma Tracy went along and got speaking to a man who, you'll appreciate in a second, wants to remain anonymous. He told Emma about how his care worker became his lover.
I think it was when we were in the shower and I got an erection. I think that was probably the turning point. Before then, I went to a beer festival with her and she gave me a nice tonguey kiss, so I knew that she was going to be girlfriend material. Then she left the company she was working for. In fact, they sacked her for going out with me, so she came and moved in with me instead, and I had her as a live-in carer. It all finished. Do you want to know how it finished? We went on holiday to Malaga together, and when we came back, after paying for the holiday, she asked me to give her payment for work that she'd done for me on the holiday as a care staff at the sort of like top prices. So I was a little bit let down and upset by that.
That's absolutely extraordinary, isn't it?
That is awful.
I just don't think you can mix work with pleasure, to be honest. It's like, I think you're treading very dangerous ground, because you build up your trust with a carer between each other, and it's almost, I see it anyway personally, as breaking that trust.
Have you ever fancied any of your carers then?
No.
Never?
Not at all.
Well, it does happen a lot though, doesn't it, Kirsty? I mean, you must have had this in your studies of people talking about their feelings for their carer becoming amorous.
Yeah, I think people are quite divided on this issue. That, as Asta said, some people are very strict and they maintain that this is business and this is pleasure and these are two very different roles. But I think for some people, it can be quite difficult, I think, if you're quite isolated anyway, that you're with this person who you might find sexually attractive. A lot of care staff are young women, particularly. And it's, you know, it can be quite a natural thing. If you spend a lot of time with someone, you're attracted to somebody. Mm-hmm. Somebody accepts you for who you are and for the difficulties that you might have with your disability and things. Then it can be quite natural. I mean, some men that I spoke to regularly fell in love, completely in love with their care staff, and it was never reciprocated, which it then causes quite a lot of sadness. So it can be quite a difficult issue.
And what advice would you give to somebody who felt that way, maybe unrequited love towards their carer? Does that mean the care relationship needs to stop if you're having those feelings?
I think so. Yeah. I think it needs to stop, because it's very difficult for the workers as well, I would say, to be on the end of that kind of attention. Whether it's over or not, I think it's a very difficult situation. And if it were me, I would end the caring relationship in that respect.
You've got to be really careful, like as I was saying before, and please don't take this in the wrong way, because I'm trying to explain it. I think you are asking me about relationships and then the escort. You've got to treat it as like a business thing as well, because you can't mix the two or you will get crushed. And to be fair, the carer is providing intimacy, and that's what we all want as human beings. Mm. But you've got to have that line.
Well, I think that's all we've got time for today. So thank you, Daryl, Asta and Kirsty. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And that's your lot for Talk Show 100. We'll be back in October with Show 101. So what aspects of disabled life would you like to see banished to Show 101, I wonder? Well, let us know about your pet hates by emailing ouch@bbc.co.uk.
And if you want to talk about it, we'll be keeping the door ajar to mop up all this sex and relationships stuff, and you can send your stories to the same email address, ouch@bbc.co.uk.
I'm really looking forward to reading some of those. So thanks to this month go to Damon Rose and to Michael Bacon, who pushed the buttons and made us all sound good. And the producer was Emma Tracy.
And just quickly before we go, I must say a massive congratulations to you, Kate. You've just announced you're marrying your long-term partner, Holly.
I am. Thank you very much.
So how appropriate at the end of our sex and relationships special. So we always end the show with a bit of music, and by a glorious coincidence, Asta, our guest, has been turning his hand to a bit of music lately. And what do you know, the boy can actually sing. So, Asta, you've got 15 seconds to tell us about your tune before we say goodbye.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I recorded this with my friend Tim Hain, and we wrote it together, and it's basically about my ethos for life of living every day as if it's your last.
So this is Dr. Positive. See you all next month.
Thank goodbye.
Goodbye.
Watch me.
Let me introduce myself to you. I used to be a wallflower too. Now my friends shout out,
hey guru,
you're gonna love my boogaloo. They call me Dr. Positive. I really, really love the life I live. And if you're feeling negative, I got the remedy for you. You call me Dr. Positive. I love the life I live. So if you don't feel so positive, I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. I'll show you a move or two. Are you ready? Let this dance begin. First, you gotta feel it within. Guaranteed to move your inhibitions. Guaranteed to get your juices flowing. They call me Dr. Positive. I really, really love the life I live. And if you're feeling negative, I got the remedy for you. They call me Dr. Positive. I love the life I live. So if you don't
do. I'll show you a move or two.
He's a man on wheels. He knows how to heat. Got no feet, but he knows how you feel. Asta Rasta, Asta Rasta. Make me wanna play my Stratocaster. Take me to the bridge.
People tell me, Doctor, you're so chill.
Doctor, you're so chill.
I say it's just because I start from still.
You don't take no pill.
I love to party, and I always will.
Always will.
But if you want to party, start with yourself.
He's a man who's never downbeat, even on wheels instead of his feet. His attitude makes him complete. Say life is short, but life is sweet.
They call me Dr. Me,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
For you,
positivity, yeah, yeah.
Call me Dr. Positive. Call me Dr. Positive.
So much to give, so much life to live. Dr. Positive.